Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of January. I don't know if you saw this article. It was in the January 3rd New York Times. It was a front page story that caught my attention because I'm getting old. We're all getting older. Some of us are just further down the road. The article was titled, A Surprising Secret to a Long Life, Stay in School. And we're going to be talking with a professor whose research really is something that is important in this whole area of longevity. We'll have two guests with us this hour to look at what may be the biggest difference in keeping young people in school. A few extra years of school is associated with extra years of life and vastly improved health decades later in old age. How did our guests find out about the importance of education? The first rigorous effort to decide whether education really changes people so they live longer began in a very inauspicious way by one of our guests this hour, Adriana Laris Mooney, who is a professor of economics and public policy at Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Adriana, thank you so much for being with us. Pronounce your last name for me. I think I massacred it there for a moment.
Thank you for having me. So, Adriana Laris Mooney, you did perfectly well.
I did it all right. Yes, okay. Yes. All right. Thank you so much for being with us. And also joining us is James Smith, who's senior economist at the RAND Corporation. James, thank you so much for being with us. Oops, we got to press that button. Hi, James. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So, Adriana, let's go to you for a moment. I understand, according to the article, were at Columbia University, a graduate student. You were casting about a topic for your doctoral dissertation in economics. And what did you find?
Well, I was really struck. I was reading this undergraduate textbook, and it claimed that there were these very big differences by education, and both in how people behaved with respect to their health and ultimately in their life expectancy. And I started to read about it, and I found some pretty inflammatory statements in the literature that would suggest that if the government was interested in improving health, that it was better to spend the money on education than to, say, spend it on medical care. And this is very counterintuitive.
Right.
And I was like, no way. And then I thought, well, the only way that can possibly be true is if, to begin with, sending people to school actually does improve their health, which wasn't obvious to me at the time. And so I set out to test that hypothesis, which to me was pretty controversial. And to my surprise, I found that evidence that it seemed to be the case, that in fact, when people spend more time in school, their subsequent health is improved because of that schooling.
Mm-hmm. And were you aware, James, of other studies done around the world that that verified this?
Well, I was a little older than Adriana, but we both came into this field really from the outside. And the standard view in health was not only that medicine was primary, but also that to the extent that SES mattered at all, it was really things like how much money you have,
mm-hmm.
and you know, how much wealth you have, not something like education. And in the work I did, I put them all together and let them compete against each other in terms of the onset of illnesses, even the onset of illnesses for people in their 50s and 60s. And no matter, every time I did it, income and wealth never mattered. Nothing financial really mattered. Health insurance did not matter. What comes through loud and strong is education, just as Adriana said.
Mm-hmm. And are we talking about higher education, the longer you're in school, advanced education? What are we talking about specifically?
It's all the way through. I mean, so each extra year of education matters. But it starts to matter more and more the further you go on. So going on to college, the 4 years in college matter more than the 4 years in high school.
Mm-hmm.
That's also, I mean, the study that I did that could not really speak to this question because I was looking at the earlier part of the century where a lot of the increases in education were in secondary schooling.
Mm-hmm.
But subsequent work has shown, and the data also suggests, that it's not really only learning how to read and write that matters, that in fact, going to college and even further years after that, they're all associated with improvements in health, mm-hmm. Which is also surprising because you might have thought when I first looked at this, I was like, oh, well, for sure, you know, if you can't read and you can't write and you can't follow doctor's instructions because you can't even read the label on something, then of course that's going to matter. But it turns out that that's possibly true, but that's not the only thing that's going on.
Mm-hmm. And tell me exactly how your study, this was a complicated study for you to do, Adriana, wasn't it? It was hard to get all the, you had to pour through a lot of data.
Well, the idea of the study is that a lot of people had noted that, yes, you know, when you look at adults, those that had more education were in better health and they lived longer lives. But the question was why, and one of the most obvious explanations for this, if I asked my mom, why is this the case, they're like, well, of course, a huge part of the reason is you had good parents and they were rich and they invested a lot in you. They sent you to school and they fed you well. And, of course, that means at the end you end up being a healthy adult with a lot of education. But there really is no effect of sending you to school on your health. It's just all reflecting your background and the conditions under which you grew up. And I really wanted to see whether we could find a causal effect of education on health. Is forcing people to school actually forcing people to go to school, is that good for them? And so what I did was trying to go back in time and look at the time where states in the United States were changing their compulsory schooling legislation and see whether those people that had been forced to go to school because of this legislation, they were actually going to subsequently live longer. And that was interesting because to the extent that people were forced to go to school, then they end up being in school not because their parents are rich or poor or treat them well or badly, but because the state compels them to do. And so if we do indeed see that their subsequent health is better, it must be something that happened because they went to school rather than because something their parents did.
Mm-hmm.
So what that entailed was going back to old documents, government documents that listed what these compulsory schooling laws were for various states and trying to identify when the states changed these laws so that we could compare somebody that was born, that was, say, 14 in 1925 versus somebody that was 14 in 1926,
mm-hmm.
and the difference between them mostly being, aside from the fact that they're 1 year different in age, the fact that one of them was forced to go to school for more years than the other person.
Yeah. So why does school make a difference, do you think, James?
Well, now we're in the really, really hard question.
Yeah.
But let me just, the way Adriana started the story remind me of something. This work that both she and I did was on the front page of the New York Times about a week ago.
Right.
And it really astounded me. It was obviously very well written by Gina Collada, but it was the most emailed article
really?
In the New York Times for about 5 days, and it's still on the top of the list. And I'm saying, wait, why is this happening? And I think one of my kids told me the explanation, and they said, because every parent is sending this article to their kids to get them to stay in school longer. And I think she basically got it right. But your question is really a good question. It's a hard question. I can give, and I don't think we have the final answer to it yet. But I can give you what my research says and how I think about it. Because I mean, what Adriana says her work is extremely important, because what it shows is it's not just the fact that people who are more educated and go on to college compared to those who stop at high school have other traits that they had anyway. It really had nothing to do with the fact they went on to school. The fact that they went on to school really matters. And there's something that happens in those 4 years of college that really matters in terms of how people think about their health. And so I think a few things are relevant. One is it teaches education. One of the things but just being there and what you have to do, you're working your mind all the time, just like you'd be working your body if you go to the gym every day. Now, people who spending school or working their mind. And that's extremely important for most of the things that involve health care. If you smoke when you're 20, you're not going to die when you're 22. And you're not going to die when you're 30 or even get sick when you're 30. It's something that's going to happen to you 30 or 40 years. And you have to really start taking that into account when you make decisions now. And so that's something I think that education really helps you to do, is understand the abstract notion that there is a future out there. There is a future cause. It's not just what how you feel now about something. Taking medicine very often has unpleasant side effects of the moment. And it's something that's happening in the future that you really want to consider. And the ability to think abstractly along those lines, to take into account the future, really, really matters.
So we do learn to live not just in the moment. We learn to live beyond the moment the longer we're in school.
Yes.
Well, I mean, one could even argue that being in school, per se, teaches you that, in the sense that most people go to school not necessarily because they find it pleasant, but because we are taught and people tell us that it's a good thing, that we will have better futures by going to school and better earnings and all these other things. And so you are being patient by staying in school. And the reason you stay in school is because you think in the future it will be good for you. So, in fact, it's like you're practicing this in some sense.
So when Adriana was a graduate student, in that story you told earlier, being a graduate student in economics is extremely stressful. And the idea, I was one, and the idea that this is healthy for you, right, going on to all, it seems a bit strange, but it is, right? And it is the fact that the moment is not the primary thing here, especially when you think about something like health. So more educated people are much less likely to experience an onset of a disease. It's much delayed with them. They're much more likely to have their diseases diagnosed as opposed to being undiagnosed. And they're much more likely to adhere to the proper treatment of the diseases once they have them. And all those things combine into finding the effect that Adriana find on mortality.
But you also, let's talk a little bit about the correlation between having some money and living longer, too, because in order to go to school, at least in this country and in most countries, it takes a whole lot of money, right? So if you're richer, your chances of going to school longer are much greater, thus you're going to live longer.
Well, that's your parents' money, not your money. So my statement about money doesn't matter is really your money as an adult. So if you're a 40-year-old and you have a lot more money than someone else's 40-year-old, that's what doesn't matter. The money, even the work I find, the money that your parents have influencing your childhood health, which itself influences your health as an adult, that does matter.
Yeah.
So the income of your parents matters, but your income as an adult and passing through life is what doesn't matter.
You want to respond to that too, Adriana?
Well, I want to say that, I mean, a lot of people always think it must be the money, and it certainly money could matter, but when you think about why the more educated appear to be healthier, you can see that money is not necessarily the key. The key differences are, why do some people have a heart attack at age 40 versus age 60? So as James was saying, like, when is the onset of disease happening? And what determines what you have a heart attack, among other things? Well, things that we know, whether you smoke, whether you exercise, whether you eat properly, are you overweight, do you have a stressful life? Then when you go and look at those things, you find, lo and behold, more educated people are less likely to do all of the bad things and more likely to do all of the good things. Now, a lot of those things don't really cost money. In fact, it's the other way around. Smoking these days is very, very expensive. So you might wonder, well, why would less educated and poorer people do it? But the fact is that they're much more likely to do it than richer, more educated people. And so what that tells you is that the money you have in your pocket at any one point in time doesn't necessarily have that big of an effect in the long run, because the bigger effects are all the things that you are doing for all of those years that ultimately determine whether you have that heart attack at age 40 versus age 60. And so it must be something about how people are behaving pretty early on and all throughout their lives, that ends up having this big impact. And so for sure the money at some point will matter. You know, if you can't get to visit your doctor, well, that possibly has an effect. But the bigger problem is whether you need to go to the doctor to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually ends up being a function of most of the things that you do, many of which don't have much relationship with whether you have a lot of money or not, directly in your pocket to spend or something.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests in just a moment. I don't know if you saw this article. It was in the New York Times on January 3rd, and it looked at the one factor that researchers agree is linked to longer lives in every country where it's been studied, and that is education. We're talking about the studies of both of our guests this hour, and welcome to your phone calls as well. Adriana Liris-Mooney is an assistant professor of economics and public policy at Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, and she, for her doctoral dissertation, found an idea in a paper that was published some years ago. Economists noted correlation between education and health. If you want to improve health, you'll get more return by investing in education than by investing in medical care, and she did a major study on that. James Smith, senior economist at the RAND Corporation, has analyzed data from the National Institute on Aging's National Health and Retirement Survey, asking whether getting richer made people healthier, an effect that could translate into a longer life. The findings were it does not, after studying large increases in income during the stock market surge of the 1990s. So we welcome your phone calls. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, this was a listener request some time ago, and we're happy to have the director and writer of Who Killed the Electric Car with us tomorrow during this hour. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Oh, dear. And our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. And we go to Charles from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. I wonder if your study allowed for the fact that people with doctorates don't get jobs in rock quarries, coal mines, or asbestos mills.
Hmm.
And, you know, some people have high native intelligence but are prevented by circumstances from going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And what's their life expectancy? And I think that's enough to burden you with.
It's not a burden at all. It'll be interesting to work our minds over on that. Adriana?
In the original study that I did, I could only see whether people who were forced to go to school for longer periods lived longer subsequently. But I could not actually directly look at whether that was because people with more education got different jobs or not. But subsequently, I've been working on this, and James, I'm sure, will have something to say about this. And clearly, occupation matters, and it matters for health. But in my work, I have not found that to be the primary reason why the more educated seem to be so different from the less educated. So part to answer to your question is that those things matter to health, but they don't seem to explain much of why the educated are different from the less educated.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of your question has to do with how smart people are. And again, in my study, the idea is to just see whether people who were forced to go to school, so regardless of whether they were very smart or not very smart, whether that mattered. And you may think that forcing people who don't want to be there in school is not such a great idea, but it turned out not to be the case. So part of the reason why I wanted to look at this experiment where people were forced was precisely because I wanted to understand whether this effect of education that people had noted was due to the fact that sometimes more smarter people would stay in school longer. But that did not seem to be the case. Kind of the attraction of this design of the study was that all people, smart and not smart, would be forced to go to school for more years rather than less. Now, of course, when you look at the data afterwards, people who are smart, they're also more likely to to live longer. But again, my studies showed that education has an independent effect. So regardless of whether you're smart or not, it seems to be a good thing for you to stay in school. It's very hard to know how much, to answer the last question, which was how big are the differences in life expectancy by ability or IQ or something. I don't actually know what those numbers are. And in part, is that there is a lot of debate about how IQ is measured, and I don't actually know of a study that has linked those two specifically. But in the work that I've done, it's certainly the case that people with higher, say, ASQT test scores tend to also be healthier. But again, it seems there's an additional year of education regardless of what your IQ is. So I don't know if James wants to add something to
that. Yeah, James missed some of that. I inadvertently dropped that button that had James on the line, so I don't know how much you heard of that.
Well, I heard enough in the answer to at least come in
okay.
on that part of it. And, so I think I basically, as always, mostly agree with what Adriana said.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are multiple aspects of intelligence, and some of them matter and some of them don't. So in my work, the one thing that actually surprised me that it didn't matter very much was people's memory. So on these surveys that I've worked with, they have memory tests, and I said, well, this has got to matter because, you know, you want to remember to take the medicine, you want to remember to do this and to do that. And it really, unless you're starting to get into the area where you're cognitively impaired, it really didn't matter at all. What mattered, in fact, was the psychological tests that more isolated the ability to deal with abstract reasoning, which mm-hmm. is more along the IQ line, and the ability to factor in the future. Having the other thing, it's not only education that matters, even though that's what we're talking about here. Having a wife around really did help. For her, having a husband around didn't help at all.
Oh, my gosh. Why is that?
Well, that just seems to me to be a rather common finding now.
Yes.
Men are helped very much in lots of areas of their lives by their wives, but outside of providing income, it doesn't seem to be symmetrical at all.
Well, that ought to change.
Well, that would be nice.
Yeah, it would be. And what about, you didn't hear the part of the conversation which I thought was interesting, the caller who talked about, you know, if you've spent a lot of years in college, you're not likely to work in an occupation. You're not in a quarry. You're not a coal miner in which there might be greater risks.
That, there is something to that, although I think that era of American history has been over for a while now. I mean, there is, in fact, one of Adriana's colleagues, Angus Deaton and Ann Case, showed, in fact, the nature of the occupation did matter. But now we're talking about those occupations you're mentioning right there really are very, very rare in American life now. So the idea that it was the type of occupation you were in is not as prominent as it once was. In
mm-hmm.
fact, in some occupations, people in the lower SES classes like farming actually had a benefit because there was so much exercise involved in the occupation itself.
Oh,
it was
right.
sedentary occupation.
Yes.
That you didn't have to run off to the gym. And this is the pre-obesity part of American history.
Mm-hmm.
And that also, and most of us, you know, and certainly in the jobs that Adriana and I have, whatever, however taxing they are, they're not physically taxing.
Mm-hmm.
We sit in a chair in front of our computers.
Right, right. Let's go to Carol from Appleton next. Hello, Carol.
Hi. I just wanted to put an extra point in here. I think one thing that's beyond a matter of how much education you've had or whether you've gone on to school is your attitude about continuing education in general. Are you interested in learning new things? Like our favorite stuff to watch on TV is like Tuesday night. There's really good stuff. There's Nova, and then there's another science show after that, and then there's Frontline, and there's educational, interesting things. And this is the kind of thing we like to watch. And Discovery Channel and History Channel and things that provide a little information, and there's some excitement in that. And
mm-hmm.
I like learning new things on the computer, you know, that's required in the job. And I'm one of the first to figure things out and tell other people how to do it where I work. And it's just a matter of, I think, your general attitude toward taking in new information, looking for it, being interested in it, whereas some people aren't interested in learning new things, whether it's about their health or whatever.
So if I can say something about that, it does turn out that more educated people are more likely to know about new drugs and new technologies and are also more likely to start using them first. And it often, you may think some of that is, again, because of money, like newer drugs are more expensive. But that's not really always true. So part of what could be is that when you are in school, you learn to be more receptive to some ideas. You learn to be more interested in it. And so it could be that part of what education does is, you know, as you said, make you more interested in new things, make you more interested in learning. And this has been documented in other areas other than health. It's been documented also in the workplace that more educated people are always the first ones to use new technologies and to learn how to use them. And that turns out to matter also for how much money they make. In some of the work that I've done, it seems to that may be part of the education effect, but I don't want to push it too much in the sense that there are a lot of articles in the popular press today about how if you want to live long and perhaps delay the onset of Alzheimer's and things like that, you want to remain active mentally and study and do things like that. But there actually isn't that much evidence of what the effects are of, you know, continuing being in school or taking courses when you're 65. And by that, I don't mean to say that it isn't good, just that we don't know, even though people tend to think this is a good thing.
Right. James, you want to weigh in this? James?
I mean, it's certainly an area of where there's been very little done, but there is some evidence. I mean, there was actually a very famous study of cloistered nuns.
Oh, yes.
Where they followed their writings over time. And from the time they entered to when they died. And the early, if you look at the early writings of the nuns when they were, I guess, in their 20s or in their teens even, the ones who were writing and just more engaged in the mind and writing more complicated things, lo and behold, they tended to end up living longer than those whose writings were very cryptic and not very abstract or detailed. So, you know, this is, we are talking here about the frontier of science. So not everything is known. We have little hints here and there. But there is some evidence that besides the popular press rendition of it, which is probably overdrawn, that keeping an active mind is really important. Now, I'm not going to claim that listening to public radio in Wisconsin is going to add years to your life.
Why not, James? Please, make the claim.
there is some evidence that points in the direction.
Right.
There's also an element of common sense involved as well. I mean, it's not a deep leap that it might matter in the same sense that exercise of the body might matter.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the case that the evidence is very sketchy.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, considering the numbers of people in the baby boom generation and out of their own self-interest, the numbers of studies on this will be growing quite a bit in the next few years. What do you think?
Part of the reason it's going to grow, in fact, part of the reason I didn't work on this topic 10 years ago, and obviously Adriana didn't, but a lot more people are working it now, is that the aging of America and the aging of the world makes people much more interested in longevity. People want the desire, the extension of life, and not just the extension of life, the extension of a good life and an active life and a vibrant life. And these are things we all want. And so there's a lot more work being done on this to try to understand what the factors are that may push it in that direction. And the 20th century, I think, if I have Adriana can confirm it, I think the life expectancy at the beginning of the 20th century in the United States was 50 years. Now, a baby girl is born, say, in Wisconsin today, has a 50-50 chance of living to 100.
Oh, my gosh, isn't that something?
It's just an enormous accomplishment.
Yes.
Over this period of time.
Yeah. Carol, are you still with? Did we cover everything? Carol's gone. Thanks very much for the call. Adriana, did you want to say something here?
Well, I wanted to say that another reason why there's so much interest in this topic is that both in the U.S., but more interestingly in European countries, it's been at the end of the war, there were a lot of programs, social programs that were introduced, national health insurance in Britain, for example, this, multiple insurances with respect to work, like disability insurance, work, unemployment insurance, etc. And a lot of people at the time had predicted that this would mean that there would be essentially, ultimately, very little differences across the socioeconomic ladder in terms of how people fared in terms of their health. And surprisingly, that has not quite been the case. So in spite of all of these protections that the government has put in place in many of these countries, we've seen the average health of the population increase a lot, but there remains a significant amount of inequality in terms of how the better-off people fare off compared to the worse-off people. And so that has also renewed the interest in trying to understand why these differences remain and why in some cases they're even larger than before, when at first cut you would have thought, oh, well, of course, now if you provide every health care for everybody for free and you give people money when they're unemployed and you have all these other protections, then that's going to be the end of why. Mm-hmm. I mean, it used to be the case, that at least it's no longer the case, but it used to be the case that people with lower incomes did not have enough food. They got sick. They didn't have access to a hospital. So you might have thought that's where all of the differences were. And it turns out that that's not quite the case. And so that's also been kind of a surprising finding that have prompted a lot of people to look into other factors.
Let's go back to phone calls. We go to Mike from Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. As a 68-year-old college student, I feel I've finally become immortal.
You're claiming too much, Mike.
I'm studying biology, and I feel that the best way to survive is to avoid being eaten by predators. So I got to tell you, your study is interesting, but basically organisms that also survive to be a certain age, aren't predictable by education. I mean, the length of life of a worm or a mouse, I don't think is predictable by, whether or not it can run the maze. Maybe it is.
Well, I'm doing a study on that, and so I'll let you know.
Are you really?
Yes.
Oh.
I don't know whether that will be the case or not, but let me just say that there are plausible biological mechanisms, although there is no proof, but there are plausible biological mechanisms for why having learning and keeping an active brain might affect your health directly. But as I said, there is no good evidence that I know of on this particular point. But we know, for example, there's some fascinating study that looked at what happened to the brains of people who pass a test to be cab drivers in London. And so it turns out to be a cab driver in London, you have to know the map of London by heart. Mm. You're not allowed to use a map. Then somebody says, take me to the street, you got to know exactly where it is and how to go there. And when they do brain scans of the people before and after they take the test, their brain shows significant differences. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it just means that there are changes in the brain, and these changes could be associated with other biological changes, hormonal factors, or other types of changes in chemical and receptors that could potentially affect health. And so it would be interesting to know the answer to that. I don't know what the answer is. We don't know.
What about professors? I mean, do they live longer than undergrads? And it seems to me a lot of my professors are not in particularly great physical shape. It seems to be that unbalanced life leads to perhaps a neglect of one's health. If you are continually studying and and at the computer 10 hours a day, you're not particularly eating right or getting exercise. And I can see where undergraduates would be healthy. They have to run around with 15-pound textbooks and go all over the campus. But is there a correlation between, say, a professor and somebody who's, you know, it's kind of hard to express this because I don't know your experiment exactly. I don't know how many people you had in your sample. I have no idea about how you picked your sample.
Let me just restate. When I say that education matters, I am by no means saying that there aren't other things that matter.
Right.
And that education is the only determinant of life expectancy or the differences between people. Obviously, there are many other things that matter. Being female is still associated with increased life expectancy, and that is net of education and many other factors. Not being white in the United States is associated with much lower life expectancy, and again, that's also true whether or not you're educated or not. So I don't want to push this too much. What we have found is that there is an effect of education, that effect seems to be important, and that it is sizable, and that it is comparable to the effect of being female, for example.
Mm.
But by no means does that matter. Does that mean that exercise or eating behavior doesn't matter in and of itself?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. What prompted you to start studying biology, or maybe you've already studied, you're just continuing at the age of 68, is that what you said, Mike?
Yes.
Yeah, how did that happen?
I think that the biology department at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is the finest department in the country.
Hmm.
We have professors there that, you know, rate fantastically high. Gerald Bertram is one of them. And I want to know what I'm made out of. I want to know why it is I'm alive and who I am. And I want to know those questions. And biology is the way to go.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, very, very much for the call. There's an inspiration, right, James?
Oh, for sure. My daughter is a biology major and studying medicine, so I'm learning through her.
Oh.
It is one of the most vibrant fields in science right now, biology, so I don't blame Mike at all for wanting to do that. One thing, and talking about professors, Adriana and I were actually, not too long ago, at a fest shift, a celebration of someone's career. And he's a Nobel Prize winner in economics. And someone said at the celebration, it's true, that we used to do this sort of thing when people were 65. Well, this man was 80.
Uh-huh.
And it's now very common to go to have these kind of events celebrating someone's research career when they're 80, not when they're 65. And,
mm-hmm.
and this particular person goes to work every day, still conducts his research.
Mm-hmm.
And as Adrian says, you know, it doesn't give you an excuse not to do anything else. So if you have a lot of education, you say, well, that's fine now. Now I can just eat like crazy and not exercise and smoke because I have a lot of education. It doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
These are all the things that education helps you not to do. Right.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. We're looking at a number of studies, two of them featured prominently in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, linking longer lives in every country where it's been studied to education. And our guests are Adriana Laris-Mooney, who is an assistant professor of economics and public policy at Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, and James Smith, who's a senior economist for the RAND Corporation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now. Doe is next from Williams Bay. Hi, Doe.
Hi. I heard a little flash. I hope you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Okay. There are too many points that touch my life and what you're doing. First of all, I'm 74 and still doing new things. It took me 22 years to get my bachelor's, 4 children, 14 institutions moving around the country.
Oh, my gosh.
And another 2 to get my master's.
Huh.
And I had help from my kids and my husband, or I wouldn't have been able to do it. And now I'm doing workshops on recharging for the next piece of life, whether you're retiring or just moving on to new things. But I want to say, one, from your programs, and I don't know which of you sponsored or which of you was hosting, two books I bought, one on happiness and the other on satisfaction. And the book that I refer to did actual brain research on what keeps us happy and moving on. And the two things that were needed, and I can vouch for that, were novelty and laughter. And there's nothing that promotes novelty more than going to school. So I think there is research out there, and it was brain research. So the books were happiness and satisfaction. But I very much believe that going to school forever is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Adriana?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the specific research that our caller is talking about, but I will look into it. Mm-hmm. I think it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. James?
Yeah, I think again, there's this is an extremely vibrant and active area of research, and they're actually doing brain imaging studies of the type that your caller just referred to, trying to understand what parts of the brain are activated by different stimuli, and what she summarized there is very much in line with what these studies are beginning to show, but it's all really new science. The evidence is fragmentary, but it's moving along exactly along that particular line.
Mm-hmm. And thanks, Joe, so much for your call. Very nice to hear from you. We go next to Melissa from Duluth. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I'm calling because I was wondering, I'm not sure if this is directly related, but with the people who were studied, now, if their social economic status didn't mean that they or meant that they were college educated, but what if they still had genetic diseases in their family? And what role would that play in basically longevity and education? Because if they were still able to be educated, but they were ill to begin with?
Well, certainly in my studies, I took into account the health of their parents and what diseases their parents had and whether those mm-hmm. diseases would be transmitted. And they are. I mean, if your odds of being a diabetic are higher, if one of your parents was diabetic, your odds of having any one of many diseases are higher. It's one of the first things doctors ask you when you go in for a checkup. Did your parents have this or that and the other thing?
Right.
So none of what Adriana and I are saying is denying that these other factors matter. People have known for a long time that your familial history matters in terms of disease. What's new here and what a lot of people did not know is how important something like education is. We know we always know it's important in terms of your economic opportunities, what kind of jobs you were going to have, but it's proving to be extremely important in many aspects of your health as well. So finding that this is education really matters is not a denial that all these other things that have been established by medical science as mattering are gone. They still matter.
Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. What I was wondering, though, is that how about educating about diseases? Because we know that iatrogenic problems where doctor-induced death or accidents, and then some of the horrible side effects that pharmaceutical drugs can deliver. What about educating the populace about those factors and enabling them to better take care of their health because they would know the pros and cons even about the medical system?
All right, Melissa, we thank you for the call. James, you want to respond to
that? Yeah, I'll give this might be slightly off the question, but it's very much related to it. One of the things I think that actually matters a lot is the communication that goes on between the physician and the patient. When I go to see a doctor, that communication is very open. I'm asking all sorts of questions. One of the reasons I'm asking all sorts of questions is I'll go on the internet and search out these illnesses myself. So I have lots of questions to ask. The conversation is very natural, and it's back and forth. And when someone who, say, is not a high school graduate goes and talks to a physician, one of the people isn't talking. Only the physician is talking. Mm-hmm. The physician is often talking using language that I wouldn't understand exactly what it is I'm supposed to do. And so that kind of is part of the training here, and I think part of the reason why education does matter, especially in the adherence to treatments, is we have to improve the ability of doctors to talk to some patients who are not their peers.
I wanted to add to that because I think it definitely is important to tell people about specific risks that they're facing and, you know, telling them that smoking is bad for them or that they should exercise or, well, basically any news that comes out of medical research that helps us understand what we should be doing or not doing is important to be communicated to people. But I want to go back to something that James was saying, which is that that is not necessarily enough. And one of the interesting things in the research that I've done is today almost everybody knows that smoking is bad for them. And they know a lot about how bad it is. They know it's bad if they smoke during pregnancy. They know it's bad for secondhand smoking. They know specifically that it causes lung cancer, that it's bad for heart attacks. Nevertheless, some people still smoke. So the question is why? There must be something beyond that information, something about how people process that information, whether they believe the information, whether they think it's going to apply to them specifically, that needs to be taken into account. So in James' example, somebody goes to the doctor, and they may be told the same information, but maybe they're told the information differently. Maybe the person responds to that information differently. Maybe somebody wants to know more, prompts the doctor. Maybe that person doesn't believe the doctor or does believe the doctor. It's hard to know, but there's something about how people receive the information and how they change their behavior as a result of that that is important. And one of the kind of frustrating things in public health in many recent years is the realization that promoting information alone is not nearly as successful an intervention as we might have thought it is. And so there are many examples about this. And so I was also looking the other day at some strange fact is more educated people are more likely to wear their seatbelts than less educated people. It takes about a second to wear your seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were asked why they do this and why they don't do this. And both educated and uneducated people think that having your seatbelt will protect you in the case of an accident. So everybody kind of knows that it's a good thing to wear it in case there's an accident. But then when the survey prompts them some more to ask about, well, why is it that you don't wear your seatbelt? Less educated people are much more likely to say that they think that the seatbelt could harm them.
Oh.
And so there's something that either the information hasn't been provided well or something else that's going on. So at a very superficial level, everybody kind of has the same information and everybody knows it's bad. But at some other level, there are some other reasons why people aren't responding equally. And I think that's important part of the research.
Yeah, running short on time. One more phone call. Daryl from Delavan. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I think to learn to listen is the first requirement. If one is not taught to listen to the world, not just around each individual, but beyond our environment and reality, and more importantly, the desire to learn of the individual needs to be there strongly. With no desire, we will not listen nor go very far at all. Thank you.
Thanks, Daryl, for the call. James?
I was listening.
So was I. So
no,
we were all listening.
I can't answer that from a research perspective, but I would say, in terms of living your life, that's good advice.
Right. I think so, too. Where can we go to get information on all of these studies? Is there a place, Adriana, James?
Well, one thing I guess you could do is email both Adriana and me. That would be the best place getting our, we'd be both happy to send you our research papers. The other thing you could also do is read that it's still on the New York Times website. You could download the piece on the New York Times. And the reporter, Gina Clotta, I thought did a really excellent job of summarizing a complex area.
I thought so, too. That's why we found you. We read it and said, ooh, there's a good talk show. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks
very interesting hour. And the piece referenced is the January 3rd. It's a front page story in the New York Times A Surprising Secret to a Long Life, Stay in School. Our guests, James Smith, senior economist at the RAND Corporation, and Adriana Laris Mooney, who is assistant professor of economics and public policy at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to John Treader and Diana Dentino for doing on-air projection. Diana is going to be a new volunteer with us, and John is she's the capable learning hands of John Treader, who's done this for some time, and we thank both of them for answering all the calls, getting them on the air. This show will repeat at 10 o'clock tonight in case you'd like to tell somebody about it, or you can order a copy by calling the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number is 111E. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.